Why not? All right.
Woo! Okay. All right. Welcome. Welcome, welcome. Welcome to the CDOT Show, presented by Inquirer Sports and sponsored by CincyShirts.com, where you can save 20% off your entire order by using promo code CDOT when you check out. I am happy to announce that as of today, the Devin Still shirt that we are selling has raised $53,000 for Devin Still's campaign to raise money against fighting pediatric cancer. So that's exciting, but check out Cincy Shirts, and yeah. So how are you, Trent? My co-host Trent Rosecrans here as always. How are you?
Absolutely fantastic.
What are you keeping busy with in this off season?
There's all sorts of always off season stuff, like tracking all the front office in Arizona. There's the Arizona Fall League. I'll be in the GM meetings next, and the Arizona Fall League in November. Then you go to the winter meetings in December, and then we'll have all the big signings that Sam's going to tell us about now, although I can just get to work early when he tells us what is going on.
Exactly.
And then, February, go to spring training. February. Oh, and CDOT show on November 13th, of course.
Yes, for those listening at home, if you would like to join us at the next episode of the CDOT show, we are live at Motor Pub every month here in glorious over the Rhine on Main Street. Come down and hang out with us at the next show, which will be Thursday, November 13th. Guests to be determined. And if you want to find out who that's going to be, as always, we encourage you to follow us on Twitter. You can follow at ENQ Sports or at Inquirer. Of course, he is at C Trent. I am at Josh Sneed. And our guest this evening is actually our first guest that we ever had on the program. His name is Sam Grossman. He is a director of statistics and analysis. Did I get that correct?
Close enough.
Okay. For the Cincinnati Reds. And the last time he was on the show, he made it sound like he'd never been on Twitter before. Or if it was, it was just creeping around. And now he's at least reading tweets.
Officially
on
Officially only creeping.
Okay.
Is my Officially status right creeping. Now.
Yep. They should follow you, though. Everyone should follow you.
Sure.
Tell them what it is.
There's not a lot to it, but yeah.
It's at?
At SD Grow. SDGRO.
There you go. That's easy. So follow Sam. So from a guy who's, in fairness, I mean, you look at the numbers pretty hardcore.
Yep.
Do you find a lot of positives to take away from the 2014 campaign in terms of, you know, the players that we may not have known what to expect from them putting up bigger numbers? Or do you kind of focus on, you know, the people who we did expect certain numbers from and didn't get those numbers?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it was disappointing in the sense that we thought we were going to compete this year. And so there were a bunch of reasons why we didn't win as many games as we thought we did. You know, I don't want to blame the injuries for everything, but that was part of it.
Sure.
But like you said, there were some really good positives. Most notably, I would say, Frazier Mesoraco.
And Hamilton.
Hamilton.
Yeah.
Especially in the first half and on defense. And, you know, he faded. We were hoping that wouldn't happen, but it kind of did. And then, you know, Simon hopping into the rotation.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us saw that lasting the whole year, but it did, and he was great.
All-star, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I'd say, overall, it was disappointing, but there's things to build on for next year. And, you know, hopefully, at least you can point to things that didn't go right that are fixable for next year.
Right. So what are you focusing on more now? The things that you need to fix, or, you know, sort of trying to find other surprises similar to kind of what we saw this year?
I think it's a lot of everything. I mean, there's certain things where, you know, we're obviously counting on Joey coming back and having Latos and Bailey and those guys healthy for the whole year. Because I think that was part of the thing with the bullpen this past year is that since so many of the starters went down, Simon had to move completely out of the into the rotation, and it just got to the point where you guys saw it, the sixth and seventh inning was pretty tough for us.
Yeah.
And so hopefully that sort of trickles down. But then, yeah, there's other things where, you know, we probably need a solution for left, and then, you know, the bench, offense off the bench and stuff like that, those are things that we know that we actively have to go out and change, I think.
Are there – I mean, I know that – probably already know the answer to this. Are there names that you guys are looking at of like this person could be a good fit that's out in free agency right now, or you probably can't tell us? Or
yeah, I can't say specific names. I think because also they're not even free agents yet, so I think that'd be tampering.
But just cover up the mic and tell me.
Yeah, exactly. But no, that's what we were doing last week in our meetings, coming up with target lists of players and also needs, because as you know, we don't have the biggest budget ever. And so a lot of it's going to have to be like we did with Chu and Leitos, where you might give up something, but you get something that helps the team now. And so it's a combination of probably some more moderately priced free agents and then some targets that have some controlled years and dollars.
That's a good use of Twitter for you. You could just ask everybody what they need.
Crowdsourcing?
Yeah, crowdsource that names list. I think that would be really good and inventive and fun,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Send it. Was it SD Grow? Send it who you want and the fake trades.
Yeah, why not?
Send them to them. Yeah. So you don't do it to me. So
do you get that off the street a lot? I mean, like, for people to know what you do?
Since we've made you famous.
I'm sure, Trent, you get that, right? Of, like, are the Reds going to get – so, like, what's the most ridiculous one that you've heard that's just
– They all are. You know, it's one of those things that, like, you know this better than I do. The way trades are really made are nothing like your fantasy baseball trade.
Yeah, honestly, I don't even know how –
Right.
The calls between the GMs go, and it's probably texts and emails now, but I know how we come up with the list of names, and I would say that part of it's similar, where you know who's out there, you know what you need, and you know what you're trying to accomplish. From there, I think people just do it all different ways.
Were there any I mean, there was a lot of really kind of big trades right there at the deadline this year. Were there any that, like, really surprised you? Like, me, Joe Smith off the street... Like, I couldn't believe that the A's would get rid of Cespedes, you know, with having some years left on his contract to pick up Lester. I don't know. I mean, that just blows my mind. Like, when you see a trade like that happen, do you ever just go, damn, that could have been us? Or
yeah.
What I'm saying? Like,
definitely.
Like you didn't even think to ask about a trade like that? Because, I mean, that was the one that really stuck out to me.
A lot of it is the financial constraints. You know, unfortunately, and I think part of it's good, part of it's bad. Because we've sort of built our core from within and locked those guys up, it's hard for us to go out and grab a guy that's making 12 or 15 million in the middle of the year. So there's some where, you know, it makes sense for that team and not for us. There's been times where there's been a guy that gets traded and we didn't maybe try as hard as I thought. The one that I wasn't working for the Reds yet, but the one that sticks out as an example is the trade. I forget who was involved, but the one with the Nationals where they gave up Felipe Lopez and Kearns and stuff. And I was interning for the Brewers at that point.
Majeski and
So that was one where it seemed like they didn't really maybe shop it as much as they could have. But it's the same as anyone else where we talk about.
Larkin, was he in the trade or did he just go to?
He never played for them.
But he went there for a minute, right?
He was in their front office.
Okay. Terrific.
But
just keeping you on your toes, Trent.
I was here for that.
But, you know, when a trade happens, we'll talk about it. You know, it's the same as anywhere. Some people like it for one side, some like it for another. And so, but I think the other thing you were asking is, do we wish that we could have made a big trade? And it depends. You know, I know Walt's trying, and sometimes it's just not there because we value the guys in the farm system because that's how we need to put the team together for the future also.
In your position, you're talking about the farm system. How do you evaluate – what do you look at from the guys in the farm system? Because so much of that is such scout heavy and you do all that. When you look at numbers, do you look at minor league numbers at all?
Oh, yeah.
And what do you like to see?
On the number side for the hitters, I think it actually sort of goes along with what we preach – at the minor league level, instruction-wise, where we want guys that have good strikeout-to-walks, you know, that aren't going to just punch out 200 times in the majors, and then, you know, guys that hit line drives and spray the ball around the field. We're not as concerned about power in the minors.
Yeah.
Because A, it might come. B, we actually, now that especially we're out of Bakersfield, we have a lot of pitcher's parks in the minors, and so the last thing you want is guys thinking if they hit 28 homers, they're going to be in the big leagues the next year. You know, so it's really about having a good approach and taking good at bats. And then if you're hitting the ball hard consistently, everything else is going to come from there.
How's the view of strikeouts offensively kind of changed over the years? Because for a long time, it's the worst thing in the world you could do. And then we've seen the last couple of years, last decade, two decades, where it's become more acceptable. And now it almost seems like there's a move back to the, you know, strikeouts are still just one out, but there are differences.
Yeah. I think part of that is because the stats have gotten more advanced, that there's a lot of different reasons. You know, A, since we have all the pitch level stuff now, you can sort of break down why guys strike out more than often. So there's a difference between a guy that just swings and misses at fastballs right down the middle and a guy that, I guess, knows himself. He's going deep in at bats, so he's walking, he's hitting for power, and the strikeouts are more a result of that.
Kind of the Joey Votto.
Right.
Would be a prime example of that.
Or, you know, David Ortiz or a guy like that. Same type of thing. And so I think that's part of the reason. And then also I think it's just because scoring has gotten lower. It's harder to just trade three strikeouts for a homer and be okay, where since it's more about moving guys along and not making outs.
So we are seeing industry-wide more towards that small ball. I mean, and I hate to use that, but...
Yeah, and I don't think it's because teams want to be small ball more. It's because there just is less run scoring, and so things like moving runners and bunting, not that you always want to do it, but there's just more times during the season where that matters, and so you end up doing it more, I would say.
Yeah, and I guess we're seeing it in this postseason. The Royals, it's kind of been a micro... Yeah. I mean, it's a small sample size, but you just see it with the Royals or this team that did it. Of course, they didn't do it as much as kind of the, you know, their reputation is during the regular season. Yep. They didn't quite do it every game.
Right. And the other thing is just because pitchers are... So many of them throw so hard and they're so good. I mean, strikeouts are going up. I don't think it's entirely because hitters are getting worse or anything. I think pitchers are throwing harder. It's more specialized. The bottom of the strike zone, there's more strikes getting called down there nowadays. And so all that leads to having to do more of the small ball stuff because you have fewer guys that can hit the ball out of the park. So then, you know, maybe your six-hole hitter used to be, I don't know, I'm not thinking of a good example, but like Jason Bay or something, you're not going to bunt with him. But now on a good team, you know, it's Lorenzo Cain or somebody. And so
Lorenzo Cain
might do that.
Batting third and laid down a sacrifice bunt, which we've never seen, and I think like the last guy to do it, I don't even remember who it was. It was crazy in the postseason. Is this how much of that is on the pitching? I mean, you touched on that. I mean, is it just that the pitching has gotten so much better? Is this all cyclical? Is almost what I'm asking.
Right. I think it is a lot the pitching, and because we talk about this a bunch, talking about the advanced scouting type of thing. You know, the pitcher is the one that's going after the hitter. So you can come up with a game plan for every single hitter. There's some guys, they don't have many holes. But a lot of guys, if you can command two pitches, there's a way to get almost every hitter out. As the hitter, you're just up there reacting. And so I just think there's a point in the preparation where you can't do anything else as a hitter. But with the pitching, you can always find something else to sort of exploit the hitter's weaknesses. Also, just I think over the past 5 or 10 years, the weight training and all that type of stuff for pitchers has really gotten streamlined, and guys are maximizing their abilities. So there's just so many more guys throwing 97, 98 in bullpens these days. Everyone's got a cutter that's like 93. And so I think it's just I do think pitchers are getting better.
Well, I remember reading something like, you know, it was a quote from George Brett the other day that said, you know, when I was coming up, Gossage threw 95. One other guy threw 95. Now everybody has five of those guys in their bullpen. Like, 95 isn't fast anymore.
Right. Yep.
It's insane.
It is. What is, why is, I mean, you said it's strength training, but do you think it's because of, for so long, pitching was hard to find, and so everybody kind of pushed guys to pitching, and then, is there any of that? I mean, can you tell?
I don't know if it's that or... You know, I know some of the guys in the draft say every year there's just more and more bigger pitchers. And so I don't know if part of it is because kids get more specialized early. There's guys that used to play basketball and football, and maybe they'd go be a Division II football player. Now they're pitching their whole life, So they're throwing 92 when they're 18. They get drafted. They keep getting stronger. And then they go from the rotation to the bullpen. And then all of a sudden, they're throwing 98. And so then, you know, I think
and they're used, you know, you can match up left, right, and throughout. And
so which makes it even harder on
a hitter.
Yeah.
Do you think that that makes someone like Chapman even more valuable because in this sea of people who 95 is where they live all day that you can bring in some guy that'll throw 103?
Yeah. You mean in the sense that hitters are starting to almost get used to the 96?
Yes, yes, exactly.
I think so. Because, you know, it's all, like I said, about the reaction time. And so the velocity plus how far he gets out extension-wise, I think it is a different look, and that's what's important.
When you're talking about approach and this kind of stuff into the minors, how much do you, and kind of some of the philosophies and some of the numbers that you come up with, how much of that and what exactly is given to these kids and probably more importantly to their managers and coaches? And what is the kind of the message from the organization?
I would say the big picture message is what I was saying earlier, that it's way more important to have a plan and an approach for every at-bat, you know, and not worry about hitting the ball out of the ballpark. And so, you know, you're going to tailor different things for different people, but it's really about that, you know, just not one of the big things that they're trying to put into place, not really in games because you don't want to get in guys' heads, but in the instructional league and stuff like that is just making sure that if you're going to swing early in the count, A, it's a pitch in the zone and probably a fastball, right? Just getting kids to recognize the breaking balls out of the hand and that sort of thing. And that's the first step, you know, right, being able to lay off pitches and that sort of thing. And so,
because I think was it under Dan O'Brien, this was before you were here, they had a thing where everybody had to take the first pitch.
Right. And that's not, there's no blanket approach. And, you know, you've talked to Jeff. He does a really good job putting those types of plans in place. But it's more about sort of the big picture, focus on, you know, the approach over the results, but then also tailoring things to each guy's individual skill sets.
So when you're looking at the minor league results, I mean, it's almost you're looking for the same thing for pitchers and hitters when you're looking strikeout to walk ratio, pretty much. I mean, is that the biggest thing you look at?
And then with the pitchers, the ground ball rate is a big thing, unless they're a power pitcher. But it really is the same, and because it makes sense that, again, now that we have all the pitch level data, they're really just trying to do the opposite of each other. You know, one's trying to get on base and hit for power, and the other one's trying to avoid that. So, but the pitchers, I don't know if – I honestly don't know if you can, like, teach a guy to have a better strikeout to walk. You know, I think for the pitchers, it's more – it is more mechanical adjustments and just focus and thinking about working your way through a lineup and learning hitters and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a bad idea, you know, to try to teach pitchers to try to get guys to swing and miss consistently.
Right. You either have swing and miss stuff or you don't.
Right, yeah.
And it's kind of funny because that's still like the great holy grail, the swing and miss stuff.
Right.
And can you guys put a finger on that statistically? Is there a way to do that?
I'd say with each sort of new piece of data that comes out, it gets easier and easier. You know, obviously when you just had the season data, you could just see, I don't think people even cared about that back then, but you could just see who struck a lot of guys out. When we got to the play-by-play level data, you could break it down by, you know, the platoon splits and all that sort of thing. Now we're at the pitch level data, and you've seen all this stuff that's like on the game day through the pitch FX, where you can look at spin rates and
the spin rates are. Can you explain spin rates to people and what does it mean and what do you take away from spin rates?
Yeah, so there's a system in every park that it's in transition, but it's either based on cameras that analyze the video or even radar now is coming into play. And so they can show that different spin rates for different pitches correlate to the effectiveness of those pitches. So for a fastball, it's the opposite, where it's the backspin. Those are the pitches that sort of look like they're rising. And it's what we were talking about with Chapman. You just want to be deceptive in some way. So, you know, that would be a pitch where, you know, the guy would chase up in the zone. The slider, the high spin sliders are the ones that, you know, have the late sharp break. So it's really the guys that are sort of away from the middle and can do something different.
So it doesn't have to be like a high rate spin rate, but if a guy's got a real low spin rate, that can screw somebody up too.
That would be like a low spin changeup would be the time that looked like they're floating in there and stuff. Yeah. And so that's the neat thing about it is you can see where the different ways the guys manipulate the ball, it matches up with what you see on the action of the pitch.
And so also, that's a way you could probably identify if they're, say, like in the Arizona Fall League, a place where it's going to have this information. Because it's not going to, you're not going to have this information in Bakersfield.
Right.
But if you have it like in AFL or somewhere, that's where you can identify maybe these guys are outliers, and even in their scouting,
yep,
when you say, oh, we're going to put this A-level guy on our list if it comes into the Rule 5 or a trade or player to be named or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's those statistics are trickling down lower and lower. You know, I think there's a company that even goes to some of the amateur tournaments now. Jesus. And reports that stuff. And so, but it's amazing how much it lines up where, you know, it used to be you'd have to go scout the guy or maybe do it off video if you had good video. And you can just see the guys that can really spin the breaking ball, like A.J. Burnett or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. And it really does line up with the numbers. And that I think that's why it's got some validity.
So it's a way to identify swing and miss stuff besides the other, the strikeout rates and scouts.
It's that and also what we were talking about a minute ago with the extension, just creating the deception of, you know, sort of an easy delivery that gets out farther. One of those guys is David Robertson, the Yankees guy. And so
soon to be free agent.
Right. He gets out really far, and he's not big. He doesn't throw that hard, but he creates deception just with somehow throwing off the hitter's perception of what he's doing.
Is there technology that tracks this? I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
Do you guys have access to it?
It's a combination. Some of it's freely available. Some of it you have to buy. And so we're trying to get
because the question I've always had, I want to know how far from that 60 feet 6 inches the ball actually is when Aroldis Chapman lets it go. Because this is a guy that's so, his arms are so long, he's so tall, and he takes those long strides.
Yep.
Because that's the one thing that always just fascinates me is this guy's not only throwing 104, right, but he's doing it at 50 whatever feet
distance,
instead of 60 feet 6 inches.
I think that Sports Center Science, show, I think they did one on him once, and I don't remember the numbers, but I think it was like 7 feet out there or something like that.
So
which makes sense when you think about his stride and the extension. And so it was
not only is he throwing 105, he's doing it from 53 feet.
And it was some crazy number where the average pitcher, it's like point something seconds of reaction time, and his was 60% of the average. I'd have to look it up. But
so adversely, when you're looking at a hitter, like what types of things are you looking for to set them aside, you know, separate them from the rest of the pack? Is it just their bat speed? Is it they just seem to be better at guessing or picking up what the pitch is going to be? I mean,
yeah, I would say the one sort of newer statistical thing that's happening is now they're not just capturing the speed of the ball in, but also back off the bat. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big one where, you know, you can always, I'm trying to think of a guy, like, you know, we all know Adrian Beltre hits the ball really hard, but now you can quantify that as a number. And so then the very best hitters are the ones that, you know, don't chase pitchers out of the zone, and when they make contact they hit the ball hard, you know. And so that's how you end up with Mike Trout or someone like that, where even if he's
I think he led
the league in strikeouts, but when he makes contact it's such hard contact that A, he's hitting for more power, and B, just ground balls and line drives are falling in more often because they're getting past the fielders quicker.
How has, when you look at it, how has all the shifting changed the batting averages? And the again, that's more advanced data and more advanced. Has that changed? Do you think a guy like Jay Bruce is maybe penalized 15 points off his batting average from the shifts? Or
I don't have an exact number, but
right,
I think that sounds in the right range. And it's definitely true. I mean, it's what we were saying with the game planning. You know, everyone knows exactly what everyone can do now, and so they're going to pitch him to the spot that gets ground balls, and they're going to play not only where he's hitting ground balls, but, you know, say he's a guy that hits the ball the other way in the air. They're going to do that also. And so, yeah, I mean, that's what I was saying before. I think it's the hardest time ever to be a hitter because of all these factors. And so, you know, it's going to get to the point where guys can either make the adjustment or they can't.
Do you see any rule changes coming on that? I mean, because the last time the batting average was this low was 1972, and then the next year they had the DH.
Or do you see something kind of like what he was saying before about how hitters were so good for so long that everybody they needed pitchers, and that has sort of cycled through. Do you see it being sort of like a pitcher-rich sport that, you know, if you can separate yourself as like a good hitter, that
right,
that is there going to be a trend for more kids to go that route?
I think it might be that, in the sense that when you said a good hitter, a guy that can sort of, you know, manipulate the bat, spray the ball around the field, react to the pitchers versus the big sort of hulking power guy, yeah, especially because people are caring about defense more.
Right.
So you've already seen that, where there's so many more guys like Brett Gardner who are starting left fielders. They weren't like the prototypical left fielder.
Right, left fielder used to be where you stick somebody like Adam Dunn.
Yep. So I think it's going to be those types of things where teams are going to seek out guys that are better, more complete hitters, not just sluggers.
Yeah.
And that's probably how.
And you'll have better athletes, and that
so
leads to better defense.
So then what's going
to
happen is there's going to be fewer and fewer guys that can't, that only pull the ball. So then they'll start spraying the ball around more, and the shifts will sort of become less effective. So I think it is going to be like a cyclical thing where it's a cat and mouse game.
Yeah, because it cracks me up to hear, like, it's usually older players who are now analysts or announcers go, I don't know why you don't just, in that pitch, you just hit it the other way. And it's like, I don't think that you
why don't
guys
you bunt?
Ever.
What's that?
Why don't you bunt against the shift?
I think there's times to do it, but, you know, it's the same thing. The pitcher's still trying to get you out. So
yeah,
you're a guy that hasn't bunted a lot, at least probably the last 4 or 5 years. And the third baseman is at least cognizant of it a little bit. And so I think it's worth it to try a lot. Or not a lot, but, you know,
occasionally.
Here and there, definitely.
Yeah. Ken Griffey Jr. used to always say, because I'm not trying to hit it there anyway. I'm not trying to hit where the second baseman is anyway.
Right.
I'm trying to hit it over the fence. Of course, that was a different era and a different time.
Yeah. And he's a different player.
Yeah. He had 600 and something. So, did all right. One of the things that we're talking about, the shift, you guys didn't use it as much, yet, you know, the stat I like, and correct, there's maybe something better out there, but I think it's always kind of simple when I look at team fielding,
yep,
is defensive efficiency. Mm-hmm. Which is simply the amount of balls put in play, how many you turn into outs. You guys led the league in that.
Yep.
And you still didn't – I mean, it didn't look like you shifted a lot. Was it subtle shifting, or was it just one of those things that in your infield, and most of, I would say, the value of your defense was your infield, or three quarters or whatever you want to get into it. Was your infield just so good that you guys don't need to shift that much?
It's a couple of things. That's sort of one of my small pet peeves. Which I guess then it's not a
peeve
anymore.
Please.
But it's exactly what you said. There were times where we talked about it more in terms of like shading. We didn't
right.
Do
other
the
teams
big
shift bad. I mean, because the Pirates, those aren't a lot of good defenders.
Yep, exactly.
And they are the ones who probably do it the most, and you see it the most. So you guys shade versus shift.
Yep. So in the big picture, we were still doing the same thing in terms of we were putting our fielders where we thought was the best position to get as many balls as possible. Because we had guys that have pretty good range, especially at short, second, and third, it wasn't these monster shifts with the second baseman way out in left field, because then you're doing yourself a disservice because you'd have guys crossing
right,
you know, range zones or whatever you want to call it. And so I think that is why you saw that. And also because the pitchers do a good job of inducing weak contact.
Right.
That's how it came together. So we weren't not shifting, but I don't know how the companies do it. I think they just pick a spot, and if there's more.
Well, you know, I think it's almost like observational. It's like
right,
the difference between shifting and shading.
So the odds, yeah, it's playing.
Yeah.
The odds.
But the fact that they put it in a bucket of either yes or no.
Right.
But for us, it's more of a spectrum where you're just moving around.
Well, it's funny because I talked to Zach Kozert about that a lot, and he says, oh, I do a lot.
Yep.
It just doesn't look that much different, but I guess a yard either way is a huge difference.
Right.
How much are you involved in that?
We produce a report every series, and then this year is really a combination of, you know, we'd give the info, and then Freddie Benavides and Jay Bell.
Yeah, because Freddie was huge in this.
Yep. And
Jay was with the Pirates as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's also about working with the pitchers. You have to say, hey, are you going to pitch this guy this way? And if not, if it doesn't line up, then you don't. Maybe don't do it at all.
Right, because so, if the pitching says, well, I want to pitch him outside, a left-handed batter outside, and that's the best way to get him out,
right,
you don't want to –
Yep.
Because so you guys kind of had some of that early, because it looked like first couple series there was more of the shift. Or was it just because it was Matt Adams and he had a couple hits?
I think it got overblown, and I think a couple of those were ones that just happened to happen. There was also one to Granderson where it was like way outside and he just poked at it and it ended up being a double. You know, I think those just kind of happened, and since it was that was part of with the new coaching staff, it took a little bit of time to evolve. But like you said, I think we did do a good job getting to as many balls as possible.
I mean, what do you like for what the layman can get their hands on for defensive ability? What do you like to look at?
Yeah, so that's on the team level. That's you're pretty much all the way there with that
because it's just simple.
So right, it's just you know for every ball in play, you know, so basically every ball that's hit that's not a home run.
Yeah,
what percentage of them does the defense turn in and out? So it is simple, and it tells you everything. Once you get broken down to the player, we use a variation of, you know, the range stats, whether it's UZR or some of those.
But how much of that is affected? Because, you know, you think about a guy like Jay Bruce. Jay's UZR probably went to crap this year because last year, I mean, what you have here, it says it did. Because last year he's going into other zones to make up for Chu, who didn't have as good a range as Billy Hamilton,
right.
And Billy can go and cover more ground. Does that, I mean, those things are, you almost have to take everything of these, every stat, you almost kind of have to take grain of salt and how they interplay with each other and fielding maybe
more. Portion
more.
That it's all a grain of salt. And we try to not look at, it's just not to the point where the information's good enough to look at a 1 year sample. Because, you know, you're talking about maybe 200 balls that he gets to every year and 90% of those are really easy plays. And so it's those 15 or 20 border plays every year. So that's why you need 2 or 3 years to really make a.
It's one of the funny things, though, because, like, you know, a guy can go from 29 to 32. A lot can happen in those 3 years. And so you're looking at when he's 33.
Yeah, does
when you finally have enough data to make a choice, he could be a different player.
Yeah, exactly. And back to sort of getting balls taken away or not, the way that it's supposed to work, I think if you're a really good fielder, you could probably pick up some range points or whatever you want to call them, going way out of the zone and making plays that other guys aren't. But if it's two basically average guys, it's like I said, there's so many plays that both guys have a chance to get to that I think it happens less than normal. Because if it's a play that Billy runs down and dives for, Jay might have been camped under that with Chu.
Right.
But then it's an easy play, and so he doesn't get much credit for it anyway. So,
were you surprised at, and organizationally, at how good Billy was defensively this year? I mean, it was his second year in center field.
No, I mean, I think everyone that had seen him scouting-wise said that he just adjusted really well. And, you know, the numbers we looked at in the minors last year, he was at the top in terms of that, too. And so I think...
So it was pretty much what you expected?
I think it was. And that's why, you know, the offense didn't turn out huge, but that's why we were comfortable with letting Chu go, because I think we talked about this at one point in the past. It wasn't an even trade, but you really were close when you're trading out the offense for the defense and the base running.
So we had some first-year coaches this year, and again, from Joe Smith fan standpoint, it seemed like there was a lot of calls at third base of sending a guy that shouldn't have been sent, or is there things that you can provide to the coach to give him a better idea of who to send and when? I don't know if I'm making sense right now or not, because like I think it felt like for a long time people complained that they weren't sending guys that, you know, could have been the tying run or the go ahead run, or we weren't aggressive enough even with just stealing bases, and then it felt like they were a lot more aggressive this year, but you saw a lot more people being thrown out, like, by a mile.
Yeah. I think some of that was just some bad luck on not, like, second to home, but just some ground balls with one out where the guy was going no matter what, which really isn't the third base coach at all.
Right.
There were some times where there were some questionable calls, I think. We don't really do anything statistically on that, but it's a combination of the scouting reports, just making sure you have a good handle on the guy's arm, both the arm strength and the accuracy, knowing when you can take a chance, and then knowing your own players, and then watching a lot of video. I know the third base coaches do a lot of video work. So it's one of those things where I think they do get to the point where they say, okay, if this fielder gets the ball at this point in the outfield when the runner is this far around, it's just sort of a big geometry thing. But yeah, it's happening so fast that...
Sure.
And it's like you said, you remember, say it happened two or three times, you just remember those.
It felt like it was a lot more than two or three times. Am I wrong in saying that?
Trent was the instigator of that, so I'm going to let him...
Well, what about when it comes to the bullpen, you know, because it seemed like this year, you know, like one of the things that I was really excited about is I heard how much more of a numbers guy that Brian Price was compared to Dusty Baker. And then it just felt like a lot of times this year where you're like, okay, they're going to bring someone in, or should they bring someone in? And if they do, why would you bring in this guy who's had his ass handed to him for 2 weeks straight? And then, I mean, I think we all know who we're talking about here, but...
I think part of it is because what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, Simon got moved out of the pen, we had some injuries. There were a couple times where, honestly, there was
no one else. Yeah.
I'm not trying to make fun of anyone.
I mean, I don't wish that upon anyone, especially someone who seems like a good person and is on my favorite team. You know, I want them to succeed. But at the same time, you're just like, there's like this frustration there of like, you know, those innings that you're talking about, the 6, 7, and 8 are, you know, that was our big thing that everyone was so excited about. It's like, all we got to do is get to the 7th inning because we have three guys that can shut down 7, 8, and 9.
Right. I mean, I think that was part of it, is that, you know, none of
Marshall and Parra were
never really going, and then LeCure never really got going. And so, especially once Broxton got traded, you know, it was tough to bridge that. And sure, I think it just didn't quite turn out how Price thought it was going to in terms of having that really 6, 7, 8, 9.
Is there a way to find – it seems like finding bullpen guys is so difficult. And you never know exactly what you're going to get. Even the track record doesn't even tell you anything. You'll see guys be – great 6th, 7th, 8th guys. It seems like everybody but the dominating closer. You almost don't know what you're getting. How is there a way to track? Is there something that all the successful?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, is there anything that you can track that shows a success rate for a middle reliever, a setup type guy?
It is tough, and I think that's why. A couple things, you know, that's where you need a lot of depth, both in terms of just signing minor league free agents, and you know, like Pat Neshek this year.
Right.
Just kind of happened. You know, maybe they saw something, but I don't know.
Is it almost just you just shovel shit in there and...
A little bit, kind of. You know, because you get, I don't know, 55 or 60 guys in camp.
Well, Jumbo Diaz.
Right, exactly. You know,
that's what I was going to say, yeah.
But I think, you know, it's having a guy with good stuff that, like we were talking about, you might find on the scouting side, you might see on the stat side something he does. And then a lot of times you see... It's those guys that are young and they're maybe getting a little into like the 25, 26 year old. They're not progressing as a starter. A lot of times you put those guys in the pen.
Wade Davis. Just shoot
up. Yeah.
Wade Davis for the Royals is a perfect example.
Yep. There's a bunch, like, he doesn't throw hard, but like Craig Stammen. Yeah. You know, he's been really good for the Nationals forever. Just guys like that. I think it's those guys that are right there and can't really get through the lineup that second or third time. Those are the guys that turn in. And if you have three or four of those and they're all right in that double A, triple A range, that's when you end up with that really good bullpen depth, and it's guys with options so you can bring up and down. Because that's the other part of it, is I think we, again, not to make excuses, but because we had a lot of the same guys for 4 years and we're going to the playoffs and in big games, I think it does wear on you, because that's the difference between the starter and the reliever. You know, you don't have that 4 day off period.
Right.
You might be fatigued in like the bigger sense, even though you're not injured.
Well, I know Trent's, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I know. I was just thinking, that reminds me, I got to call Craig Stamen because he said he would be a CDOT show guest.
Oh, terrific.
He lives in Cincinnati.
Well, I know Trent's view on the role of the closer, that, you know, there's no statistics, right? Is the way you
say?
There's no statistics that back up that those outs are any more important than any other outs. Is that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the high leverage, but it's a complex view that's not so much as closer bad, but
right. But that's what I was going to ask you: is
closer bad?
No, not closer bad. But do you Do you think there is some sort of mental makeup to apply to the, you know, definitive stats that tell you that this person has what it takes to be a closer versus, you know, somewhere else in the bullpen or the rotation?
I don't think there's a different mental makeup, like, specifically for the getting the last out, you know, like for the eighth, from the eighth to the ninth. I think you do have to have a certain personality to pitch in tight spots in general, right? So for me, that could be anywhere from the fifth inning on, you know, and the tough thing for the managers is you're never going to know when the most important spot in the game is at that moment. And so, you know, I think that's the one mental side of it is you have to be a guy that is going to be okay under pressure, but it's not just the ninth inning.
You pretty much get weeded out, though, if you don't. Don't you? Through the minor leaguer?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what made me value and like Chapman more than anything else this year. I mean, not just the year that he had stats-wise, but what happened to him in spring training, how quickly he wanted to get back out there and how quickly he was like, I mean, that was the first thing I thought of when I saw him get hurt was just thinking, how could you ever be right going out there again, not and trying to forget that that ever happened, you know? And that's what kind of told me that maybe there's something different with some guys that can just shake it off and
yeah.
Not to quote Taylor Swift on our podcast, but
I don't know.
Thank you.
Wow.
Two people.
Okay, hold on. Taylor
reference.
Swift is where we should just break. Just gotta stop. We'll come back. We'll do our usual thing.
All right, we'll take a quick break here.
We have questions.
We'll take some questions. This is the C-Dot Show live from Motor Pub and Over the Rock. Welcome back. Welcome back to the C-Dot Show, presented by Enquirer Sports and sponsored by Cincy Shirts. We are live at Motor Pub in downtown Over the Rhine, Cincinnati. Please come check out what this is all about. Come be a part of our fun little audience. The next show will be Thursday, November
13th.
So
I'll be fresh off a plane from Arizona.
All right, so come see.
Hopefully I make it.
Tan Trent.
Tan, yeah, I'll be real tan.
Beard, too? You're going to keep that rocking, keep rocking that beard? That's kind of your...
It's my thing. I'm not allowed to. I'm contractually obligated.
I don't know if I've ever seen a tan bearded dude. Our guest this week, if we could make him feel any more awkward right before we bring him back in.
No, I'm just trying to think of tanned bearded.
Right? Dudes. There's not one. Maybe Happy Gilmore's caddy.
I'm thinking of...
I think there's a lot of homeless tan bearded
maybe.
Guys.
Maybe.
Not here right now in October, but, you know, if you go to Arizona, I'm sure you'll see plenty of people on the street with...
For some reason, I was thinking of the guy from Street Fighter. But
yeah.
I think he was Russian, though, so I don't think he was that tan.
I know way too much about that. But Sam Grossman is our guest. He was the first guest we ever had on this program, and it's a nice little... It's our 12th show, right?
I think it's our 13th, because we had two
okay.
1 month.
Oh, that's right, because we did Reds Fest and Sam LaCure. You're right. Well... Your first repeat guest. We're happy
it's
you're
like
back.
Closing
with
out
us.
Our first year with.
Yeah,
I'm hoping it's kind of like Wayne's World 2, where it was still funny.
It's not
enough.
As good as the first time.
Not quite
around,
as good. Still pretty funny. And really, the biggest problem was they just repeated too many jokes.
Yeah,
but the new jokes were funny. So we'll see what happens.
That's what a director of analysis gives you.
What is your official title? I didn't want to mess it up again if I got it wrong.
That's right. Director of Baseball Research and Analysis.
Baseball Research Analysis. I said Statistics and Analysis, and I was wrong. Yeah. I'm sorry.
They made it as long and vague as possible.
If you're listening for the first time, this is the portion of our show where we let folks in the audience come ask questions of our guest or one of us, which has never happened before. But
and shouldn't.
And then we'll take a couple questions. We'll turn the mics off, and then we'll continue to ask some questions and sort of reward those who did show up this evening. To get to hear some sort of extra content. So who's got a question?
Well, the line queues up and they fight over it. I will read the text message I got. I would appreciate it if you would ask Sam this. Tell him Bob from Hyde Park wanted to know how the Reds did with Zach Bunce this season.
I can guess who that's from. The Reds were
Bob
second,
from Hyde Park.
The Reds were second in the National League in sacrifice bunt success percentage. So
as much as certain members of the media would like it to not be true. We actually were pretty decent. And
well, I don't want it not to be true.
No, I didn't mean you.
Oh.
I meant some of the guys maybe on the air. But no, it's
I just don't want you to do it.
It's sort of what we were saying earlier. Like, unfortunately, we didn't have a great offense last year, and we were in a bunch of tight games. And so I agree, you don't probably shouldn't do it in the first inning. But there are times where it is the right play. And for whatever reason, people just assume. I think every team's fans would say that they are in the bottom half of the league
in success,
in terms
yeah.
of bunting
and everything, and base running,
exactly, and moving runners and all that stuff.
And moving runners, I think all of it, yeah.
For whatever reason, it's just one of those psychological things where people remember everyone that it doesn't happen, because when it's a nice easy one, it just comes and goes, and then you have a guy on second with one out, and you don't score any runs.
Well, and a lot of that I will give
you. That was a sack bunt yes. joke, by the way.
Yeah. I like sack bunt jokes. But, like, Cueto was really good, and you have some pitchers that are really good at that, mm-hmm. that play.
Yeah.
And that has to add to the success rate and also
yeah.
add to that's when you want to use that shit.
So, you know, if you had to rank things of why we didn't score a lot of runs this year, for me, that's way down on the bottom.
All right. First question. Yeah, I figured you'd know.
So if you could pick one Taylor Swift song to be your walk-up song. you mentioned earlier that more
trouble.
Balls at the bottom of the strike zone were getting called as strikes. How much scouting and research do you do on umpires, and what are you looking for exactly?
We do a decent amount. You know, it's one of those things where you don't want to overload the players. Like, yeah, I don't think you want to be thinking about that, especially when you're up at the plate. But in terms of the prep with the coaches game planning and that sort of thing, we do look at it. You know, we try to figure out what each umpire's strike zone is. Everyone's is different, unfortunately. You know, it's not standardized yet. But, you know, different guys are more lenient when there's a 3-0 count. Some guys call fewer strikes, called strikes with two strikes. So there are some things you can pick up, and even, you know, I think if you had a pitcher that was really cerebral and could put the ball where he wanted to, then they can take advantage of it, you know, going off the plate a little bit like Maddox and Glavine and those guys used to do. And so for every series, we do a little printout for each umpire and give it over to the coaches. And I think it, you know, it plays a minor role, but it's there. You know, if there's any advantage you can get, then we'll try to take it, I would say.
Freaking Bob from Hyde Park shows up and doesn't even ask the question himself.
Coward.
Texts me. Coward. All right.
I'm not in on that joke, by the way. I don't know what you're talking about.
That's why we had your mic dead, apparently. All right, let's go.
One thing you brought up earlier in like the pitching development was you're focusing more maybe on mechanics than actually trying to teach them something. Does that apply to maybe even like pitch sequence where you may see someone leaning too much on the fastball, or is, you know, that already developed at the low minors before you hit like the upper levels or even the majors?
Yeah, I think it – I would say there's not a lot of that in the low minors. You know, you definitely have to let guys – develop and really even figure out who they are as a pitcher. Like we were saying, you know, you might have a guy that's a power pitcher that can just blow people away, and then he's going to get to that adjustment period where he needs to learn how to pitch more in Double A, Triple A. You might have a guy that knows how to pitch, doesn't have great stuff, and he's picking that stuff up faster. And so I think, again, it's one of those things that's player by player, but you probably start on that maybe a little in Double A, and then in Triple A, that's where, you know, the coach, one of the coach's main jobs is actually getting guys prepared to go up to the majors the next day versus just the development of you as a player in general. And then I think once you get to the majors, you know, it's not just the pitchers, it's the combination of the coaches and the catchers and knowing the opposing hitters and that sort of thing. And so it's probably one of those things that you start to learn as you get up above A ball, I would think. But there's probably some guys that, you know, that sort of get it early, and then it's on the coaches to, I think, find that and help develop it in them, I would say.
We got one coming. Sure. Yeah.
I wasn't here earlier, so if I ask a question, it's...
No, it's going to be good.
We talked about absolutely nothing earlier.
No, that's true. Taylor Swift.
Segue from what you just talked about. You know, I read that story on the approach the guys at the Astros are taking right now in Sports Illustrated, and they discussed, like, their whole situation with the Stanford pitcher, Apple. Appel was a first-round draft pick and not doing well, and eventually they sort of broke their own rule by promoting him because he's the first-round pick with the big money behind him. Mm-hmm. But they had said, ostensibly, they wanted to focus on promoting people who demonstrated proficiency at one level before the next. And I was just curious how the Reds look at that. What's their philosophy? I mean, to what extent is it we want to be highly principled about if you haven't accomplished, regardless of what your signing bonus was or what have you, we're not promoting you. How do you treat that? And then do you stick by the 100%? Because I have seen instances where you bring guys up and I look at their stats from the previous level, and this is, you know, even worse. You're bringing them up to the Reds, not from AA to AAA. And I'm thinking, okay, he wasn't successful down there. Why in the world do we think he's going to be successful here? Mm-hmm. You know, but comment at that.
Yeah. We don't have any hard and fast statistical rules. You know, I've also heard teams, you know, you have to walk a certain percentage of plate appearances to move up and stuff. For us, it's just the judgment of Walt and then Jeff, the farm director, and the coaching staff, really just if a guy is ready to move up. That's the main thing. And there's not a set of rules in place, I don't think. In terms of knowing when a guy's ready or not, I think it's just, you know, how he's competing and whether they think he can handle the next level. And I would say your second part of your question, going up to the majors, unfortunately, we're constrained by the roster. So, you know, you've only got 40 guys. If you have some injuries, you are getting down pretty thin, where maybe somebody like Contreras, they would have hoped to have some more development time, but he's got a good arm. He was pitching well in AA. You know, and then you're also a little bit showing confidence in the player. Like, hey, you're one of our guys. We think you can handle it. And so I think it's a combination of a couple ways of looking at it where, you know, it'll – sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But you've seen times like, I think Bruce came up and he had only had like 10 games in AAA or something, and he came up and was great right off the bat. So, yeah. So, we don't have any hard and fast rules like that, and I think it's more just going guy by guy and thinking about what stage of development they're in. You know, but before you get to the majors, it's definitely... the most important thing is that individual player's development in mind, not like we need a third baseman at AA, so we're going to bring a guy up from A ball. You know, at the minor league level, it's definitely more about developing the players than having the team be a complete team, I would say.
Very cool. All right.
Hi, guys. To follow up on the point that I was listening when we walked in, you talked about how you keep stat sheets on the umpires' tendencies with different pitch counts or, mm-hmm. or ball and strike counts. To flip it around to the batting side of things, do the Reds do anything organizationally to teach their players to hit? Insofar as I've heard Jay Bruce being interviewed and asked, what do you do when you have two strikes on you? Nothing. It's like Pete Rose said, there's only two pitch counts that matter. It's like, I think, 1-2 and 0-2. And it seems like a lot of the Reds, and this is anecdotal, I don't have a lot of numbers to back it up. It seems like that when they go up, like a Todd Frazier or Zach Cozart especially, they're going up, they're swinging, might be 0-2, they're swinging for a fastball, even though the actual pitch is a curveball in the dirt, which seems to be incidental to what they're thinking. It seems like they're also just guessing a lot on pitches and not either watching the rotation of the ball or doing anything that seems like upper level thinking that you would expect from a major leaguer. Can you expound on that? And am I speaking out of turn, or I mean, just the numbers seem to bear it out.
Yeah. You know, coming up through the minors, there definitely is an approach that's being taught. I think they do a good job. Like we talked about earlier, you know, bringing a guy in, you sort of let him be himself for you know, his first summer definitely, and then maybe into the second year, and you sort of let him keep going a little bit until he starts to not have as much success, and that's when he's more often than not going to come to the coaches and start being willing to, you know, accept instruction and want to become better. And it's different person by person, but, you know, it's what we were talking about earlier, that it's really about exactly what you said, having an approach and putting good at bats and being a tough out. And unfortunately, it's just a really hard thing to do. You know, this is a total cliche, but the best hitters get a hit 3 out of every 10 times. And so it's just a tough thing to do. The pitchers are getting better and better. And so there's just very few hitters out there that can control at bats that well consistently all year. You know, we do have some guys that strike out a lot, but as a middle market team, that's just one of the things we'd like to fix, but sometimes we just have to live with. You know, Cozart's a guy that might win the Gold Glove defensively. Bruce has power. He's a good fielder with a good arm. Frazier's a good defender. And so I think a lot of that you're seeing, I get that it's frustrating, and it's more just that we're trying to have complete players. And, you know, unfortunately, we can't have 9 Canoes out there who strike out 50 times a year. So it's definitely something that we focus on and we hope will improve. I'm not going to say that it wasn't an issue and didn't contribute to us having bad offense last year, but we're trying. We're cognizant of it.
Nobody's ever looked good striking out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it does seem like, and I love Jay Bruce, but it seemed like there's almost like a clockwork thing to it of, he gets down 0-2, it's going to be a curveball away, and he's going to swing and miss at it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, and again, maybe it's to your point of like, you just remember the times that happens, but if it does feel like that is one case of like, it seems like that's the one pitch when he's down the count that he can't hit. Is there a way to just work on being better at hitting that pitch?
I really think he is. And that's the thing about a guy that's been in the same division for 6 or 7 years now. You know, with all the preparation and video and scouting and data that's out there, they know exactly how to exploit every single weakness.
Right.
You know, so it might even be things that we're not seeing where he's getting set up by the pitch before that, you know, and that's throwing him off mentally or I don't even know. And so I really think part of it is that, you know, the other side of it has just gotten good at it. But,
and it's very easy for, you know, me to sit there and be like, here's what he's throwing, get ready for it.
Yeah.
And
are there any players who've come to you?
We've had a few. I probably shouldn't say who they are, but
right.
Yeah, we've done some. There's a couple of guys that are, you know, pretty advanced thinking about it. And it's definitely in the off season where, you know, hey, you know, are you seeing any ways that I can improve? And I think Don Long has done that too, where, you know, he's sort of done some, I'm just making this phrase up, but like reverse advanced scouting, where saying like, you know, this is how people are trying to get you out. I think the dangerous part of that is, like we were talking about earlier, because the hitting is so reactionary, one of the worst things that you can have is to have a guy thinking a bunch of thoughts as it's happening. You know, if you think about it, like if you're playing golf or pool or something, the minute you start overthinking it is when you just get in your own head. And I think this is another cliche, but you sort of just have to clear your mind and react.
There was an article I read, I think it was last spring, where some guy, it was a batter, a really good batter, I don't remember who it was, he was talking about it. He's like, you just can't think too much. You can't analyze every pitch unless you're Joey Votto. He's the only guy who can do it.
Yeah. But I think, you know, there was an old article about Manny Ramirez, I think, and that's what he was really good at, was just clearing his head. Obviously, he was good at, you know, he had great vision. He picked up the spin like you were talking about, and he had great hand-eye. But that's part of it, too, is just all you're thinking about is seeing it right out of the hand as early as possible and reacting.
There was also, I think a hitting coach once told me, you know how you get guys who can walk and see the approach? You don't develop them, you draft them. And that's one of those things. These are talents.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's part of it. it really is hard to change who a guy is because, you know, you think about it when a guy gets to the majors, even if he's 24, he's been playing that way since he was like 8. So
are you involved any in the draft?
Yeah.
We're in there.
We look at the statistics we have there too, and it's the same thing. We're trying to fit guys that fit what we're looking for, you know. Again, it's a well-rounded thing where we're not going to draft only guys that are high average, low slug. You know, they're going to get some raw athletes. You're going to get some pitchers that, you know, sink the ball, some guys to throw hard. I think that's the goal on that side, is to just have a wide range of types of players. But it's the same thing. There's more and better stats coming out every year on that too. And so,
yeah. Like
it's kind of,
I guess, from a lot of those maybe from the, like, those showcases and all, and they'll have those in major league parks.
Some of that, and some of the spin rates. You know, more and more conferences are tracking at the play level, so you can get a lot of split data now and stuff. And so you can overthink that too, but it definitely helps. Where it's amazing how often the scouting report and what we're seeing in the numbers do line up. You know, that guy struggles against the better pitching, so then maybe he's way worse in conference and out of conference when he's facing the better pitchers, or on Fridays against the top pitchers in that league. And so there's more of that every year, I'd say, too.
All right, let's take one more question, and then we'll shut the mics off and reward those who've attended tonight with some extra content. But this will be the last question for the podcast. Yes?
Sam, was there any stat, particularly in the minors, too, where you saw a guy and it was just, wow, that is off the charts, we weren't expecting that, kind of this really stood out and popped out, by who or anyone you can talk about?
Yeah, that's a good question. This is just off the top of my head. I'd say somebody like Mejias Breen. You know, he was an 8th rounder, and I think it was his first summer in Billings and then Dayton and Bakersfield. He was really close to having the same number of strikeouts and walks, which you don't see very often, especially from a guy that far down in the draft. And so I think he was a guy that, I've said this a bunch, but the scouts saw it too, where he put himself on the map really quickly, where if you just have a college third baseman that's an 8th rounder, more often than not, he's going to play a couple of years, fade out, maybe kick around the minors for a while. But he's turned himself into a real prospect based on producing. You know, he didn't come in with the huge pedigree, but he's done it by, you know, taking good at-bats and playing good defense and all that stuff. And so that's one that just, I guess, sort of popped in my head first.
Very cool. Well, thanks to everyone who's listening at home or however you may be listening, that you weren't in attendance. We appreciate you joining us once again. We do invite you to come down and be part of our fun crowd here at our next event. The CDOT show will be Thursday, November 13th here at Motor Pub in Over the Rhine. So come down and hang out with us. Want to thank our guest this week, Sam Grossman. You can follow him on Twitter at SDGrow. And
not a lot to follow.
Well, tweet at him and encourage him to start putting this stuff out there.
I'll take it in by osmosis.
There we go. And you still have the default picture of the egg as your Twitter picture.
I don't think SD Grow is you.
No, no W.
Oh, yeah.
You can follow Trent.
Sharon Grow is going to get a lot of weird tweets coming up.
You still have the egg pic.
You still have the egg, yes. 21 followers.
Follow Trent. He is at C Trent. Of course, you want to follow at ENQ Sports and at Inquirer.
Most importantly, SD Grow follows me.
Do you follow me?
I think I do. Maybe since he shirts.
I don't want to know now. Now I don't want to know. So on behalf of our guest Sam Grossman and my co-host Trent Rosecrans, we want to thank you for joining us for another action-packed and educational episode of the CDOT Show. I've been your host, Josh Sneed. We'll see you next time. Thank you guys for listening.
Following Josh Sneed.